dark heart of the city, a mysterious figure known as Dr. Bones.
Hey, 1940s band singer, what's the big idea? You been hitting the sauce again? Well, in any case, I appreciate the sentiment. And by the way, this is the Hour of Doom!
And Bloom!
That's right, friends and neighbors, welcome to Doom and Bloom's Survival Medicine Podcast, a fortress of fealty in a feckless world. And the number one show about medical preparedness, mostly because it's the only show about medical preparedness.
Probably.
Very likely.
Yes.
And who am I? I am Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones of the award-winning survival website doomandbloom.net. And here is my wonderful co-host.
Hi, Amy Alton here. I am a nurse practitioner and a certified nurse midwife, and also known as Nurse Amy.
And beauteous purveyor of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. She's so sharp, by the way, that Nurse Amy, that when she looks daggers at you, you actually bleed.
No.
Yes.
That's not true.
Because you're so sharp. You really are. You really are. You know, on this show, you're going to get the conventional medical wisdom. You're going to get the unconventional medical wisdom. Plus, at no extra charge, the unfiltered rants of a man well into his second childhood. But whatever it takes to make your family medically prepared for times of trouble, you know what? You're going to hear it right here. But first, you got to listen to this.
Absolutely. All information and opinions voiced on the Survival Medicine Podcast are for entertainment purposes only and do not represent medical advice for anything other than post-apocalyptic settings. We strongly urge our audience to seek modern and standard medical care whenever and wherever it is available. Please.
Or don't, if World War III is just a fender bender to you, tough stuff. But answer me this, who's going to keep your family safe and healthy when times get tough? When the hospitals are out of commission, when the doctors are gone, and someone you care about is sick or injured. Well, don't look at me. I'm just a motherless child in the orphanage of life. Oh, it's you, guy, buddy, old pal. You and I both know that when it's least expected, you're going to be elected. So get off your duff and learn some stuff, and why not get some medical supplies while you're at it? I'll bet Amy could tell you where you'll find some.
Absolutely. Store.doomandbloom.net. Where you'll find all kinds of first aid kits. Little ones, easy to carry, mediums, great for your car, your home, and the big ones for it's the end of the world as you know it.
And I feel fine.
Yes, you feel fine because you were prepared with medical supplies.
That's right, our entire line of one-of-a-kind quality kits. Hey, I just want to mention that the Book Excellence Award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, The Essential Guide for When Help Is Not on the Way, still ranks a whopping 4.8 out of 5 on Amazon over 3,100 reviews, and is still tops on bestseller lists throughout the country. If you haven't checked it out yet, you'll find the black and white version on Amazon and the color version at store.doomandbloom.net. We even have a color spiral-bound version on our website.
That's right, specially made.
That's right. In the news, a potent storm system brought days of severe weather across the southeast, heralding the start of, guess what, tornado season. Sure enough, every year, lives are lost to the high winds and flying debris that can lift a home right off its foundations. And every year, around this time, I do a show in which I talk about it. The most recent outbreak of severe weather swept across several southern states, producing a number of twisters, many in the state of Georgia, where my wife's father lives, and that's, of course, always concerning since he's getting on in years. Every year, we can be pretty certain that early spring to midsummer is going to bring on tornadoes in much of the country, but some of these, well, they ignore the normal timeline and come early or late. I remember reporting on one just last December. Now, if I had to choose between being in the path of a major hurricane or a tornado, well, what would you prefer? Me, I would prefer the hurricane. And why is that? Well, even though more territory is hit by the hurricane, a lot more territory goes through entire states, you know, they're pretty much predictable these days. I mean, you get time, usually several days, to prepare for them. Tornadoes, well, not so much. It's the element of surprise that leads to hundreds of people killed sometimes by these things, and it's certainly injured on a yearly basis, and knowing what to do before a hurricane touches the ground, that helps provide protection against many tragic outcomes. So I said a twister is just another name for a tornado, and of course everybody knows that. If you don't know what it is, it's a violently rotating column of air that is in contact with both the surface of the Earth and a thunderstorm, sometimes called a supercell. These things are spawned by, you know, pretty severe thunderstorms, and they can cause a lot of damage. From a distance, they appear to be like a visible dark funnel with all sorts of flying debris in and around it. Now, they may be difficult to see up close due to accompanying rainfall. Hopefully, you'll never get that close to it. I did, and I'll tell you about that a little later. Now, almost 1,000 tornadoes touch the ground in the United States every year, and that's more than that are reported in any other country, and most of these occur in what we call Tornado Alley. That's an area that isn't really officially defined, but it encompasses the land essentially between the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachian Mountains. Peak tornado season in the U.S., at least in the southern states, is March through May, and northern states is probably a little later, late spring through early summer, But the truth of the matter is that they can occur really any time, and it seems to have been shifting over the years. Maybe a little more to the east in recent seasons. Most tornadoes average about, 500 feet, maybe 150 meters across, and they travel on the ground for about 5 miles, that's about 8 kilometers, generating winds that can go all the way up to 300 miles per hour, and often accompanied by hail, as if the wind isn't enough. Well, while in contact with the ground, twisters travel at about a speed of 30 miles an hour. They can travel faster than that sometimes. That's about 48 kilometers per hour. Others may hop from point to point before petering out. And I was actually exposed to one of these guys, and I don't ever want to be exposed to one again. If you're in close proximity to the funnel, well, you're going to hear a roaring sound. That's going to remind you of like a passing freight train if you were exactly 1 foot away from the track. And I have personally experienced this decades ago. When I bought my first house about 3 weeks afterwards, a tornado actually bounced up and down the block and actually hit my house and the house next to mine and the house down the street and wound up knocking off some tiles and knocking a couple of trees down. And I was in the house at the time and it sounded like, well, a freight train passing by the front door. And I had to actually push my body against the front door. I actually sort of felt it buckle in towards me. I managed to survive it, but boy, oh boy, that was a scary experience. Never want to have it again. So you can imagine, from a medical standpoint, the injuries from tornadoes are usually due to trauma from flying debris carried by the winds, or by damage if people that are in a flimsy structure, like, let's say, a trailer home. Bad idea. I actually read a report that goes all the way to 1931 that an 83-ton train was lifted and thrown 80 feet from the tracks as a result of a tornado. Now, there are various classification models for tornadoes, but the most commonly is known as the Enhanced Fujita Scale. I guess old Professor Fujita gave us this. And Fujita levels are rated from 0 to 5 based on wind speeds and the amount of damage caused. So, for example, a F0 would be winds that are 65 to 85 miles an hour, and you can expect maybe smaller trees uprooted, maybe branches broken, some mild structural damage with something like this. But then it goes up. Moderate is about 86 to 110 miles per hour, and F2 is considerable, winds 112 to 135 miles an hour. In this circumstance, you can imagine that a mobile home would probably be destroyed, and you might see major structural damage to frame homes due to flying debris, and some large trees would definitely be snapped in half or uprooted. And F3 is worse than that, 136 to 165 miles per hour. You would see the roofs torn from homes, small frame homes completely destroyed, and most trees would be snapped and uprooted. F4 is devastating, 166 to 200 miles an hour, and F5, incredible, winds greater than 200 miles an hour, larger buildings lifted from their foundations, trees snapped, unrooted, even debarked, and objects weighing more than a ton become airborne missiles. Wow. Well, although most places have sirens or other methods to warn you of an approaching tornado, every family should have a plan of action before a tornado appears. Children should know where to hide in the home, find medical kits, and use a fire extinguisher. That's sort of important to let young people know exactly what to do. If it's appropriate, teach everybody how to safely turn off the gas and electricity. Now, when you're in the path of a tornado, you got to take shelter immediately unless you happen to live in a mobile home. If there's time, it's much better to get to the nearest solid building that has a tornado shelter, and underground shelters are by far the best. If you live in Tornado Alley, you might consider putting together your own underground shelter. You know, unlike bunkers and other structures that are built for long-term use in survival settings, a tornado shelter only has to provide safety for a short amount of time. I mean, as such, it really doesn't have to be very large. Maybe 8 to 10 square feet per person would be acceptable. Despite this, you got to be sure to consider ventilation and the comfort or special needs of potential occupants. Now, if you don't have a shelter, you want to find the safest place in the house where family members can gather. Basements, bathrooms, closets, inside rooms without windows, these are the best options. Windows, remember, could easily shatter due to impact from flying debris. Speaking of windows, some people suggest that opening windows due to the great pressure caused by a tornado will help decrease damage. Well, honestly, most windows are made of about a quarter inch pane of glass, so you're not really going to prevent your roof from being blown off by simply opening a window. It's the speed and violence of the winds, not the pressure, that causes the most damage to homes. Now, for added protection, get under a heavy object such as a sturdy table and covering your body maybe with a sleeping bag or a mattress. That'll provide additional shielding. You want to discuss this kind of stuff, this plan of action, with every member of your family until it's clear that they know this process by heart and that they know exactly what to do when the time comes. Now, if you're in a car and can drive to a shelter, you should do so. Although you may be hesitant to leave your vehicle, remember they can be easily tossed around by very high winds. You may be safer, actually, in a culvert or ditch or other area lower than the roadway. It's not safe, however, to hide under a bridge or an overpass as the winds can easily reach you. Now, in town, you want to leave the car to enter a sturdy building. That's an appropriate course of action. But if there's no other shelter, but you may be in a situation where there just is no other shelter. And if that's the case, staying in your car will prevent you from some flying debris. You can keep your seatbelt on, put your head down below the level of the windows, and cover yourself as much as you possibly can. If you're out hiking when the tornado hits, wow, definitely not a good thing. Get away from heavily wooded areas because torn branches and other debris are going to become missiles. So an open field or ditch actually may be safer. Lying down flat in a ditch or other low spot in the ground, that'll give you a little bit of protection. You want to make sure to cover your head with your arms, if at all possible, or even just your hands. Better than nothing. If you have pets, you want to make provisions for them in your emergency plan. You may have a local disaster shelter that has supplies for humans, but no supplies for pets, and so you may have to bring all your own stuff. You should check with your local municipality to find out what provisions they have made for pets, if any. If you end up trapped in a building that's been damaged, well, try to cover your mouth with a cloth or mask to avoid breathing dust. That's going to be important. You want to try to send a text if you have your cell phone, which is a good idea at all times. If you don't have your phone, you want to bang on a pipe or wall or use a whistle instead of shouting. That having a whistle on a keychain is never a bad idea because you can use the whistle and expend less energy instead of shouting. So you can save your breath. Now, after a tornado's passed, there is cleaning up to be done in almost all cases, so you have to be aware that some injuries can occur during the process of putting your property back together. So wear appropriate gear such as thick-soled shoes, long pants, work gloves, eye protection, and use appropriate face coverings or masks if you're cleaning up areas that might have mold or other dusty kind of debris. This portion of our program is sponsored by the Talking Dogs Podcast. Join Gizmo and Slobbers, two golden retrievers from the future who, thanks to special brain implants, can talk and discuss issues that concern canines of all stripes in today's cat-centric world. Left by accident in the T-4000 time machine while their owner was buying space cigarettes, Gizmo and Slobbers spend their day discussing important questions like, who's a good dog? Who wants to go for a walk? And who's my favorite little buddy? Plus, timely topics like squirrels, evil geniuses, or just evil? Are they worse than ducks? Get your morning woof on with Gizmo and Slobbers. You'll be glad you did. Available on all super futuristic streaming platforms in the fifth dimension. You know, aspiring family medics often ask us at these events that we go to or when they see us on the street or they email us, what exactly do I need to know? Boy, that's a tough question because the answer is really as much as you're willing to learn. There's a pretty large list of medical issues that could occur in an off-grid setting, and that'll give you a good idea of the skills that you'll need. You can expect to deal with lots of ankle sprains, the common cold, other respiratory infections. You'll get cuts, rashes, other common medical issues that affect people in normal times. And a lot of it involves very basic stuff, like dehydration due to lack of drinking water, safe drinking water, that is, or maybe due to diarrheal disease from failure to disinfect it. Poor preparation of food. It's thought that Ebola was passed to humans in Africa from failing to completely cook bushmeat. They were eating bats there. And then there's illness related to climate, such as hypothermia due to cold exposure, or heat stroke due to heat exposure. People are driven from their homes and the power grid fails. They find themselves without adequate shelter from the cold or the heat, and you'll wind up having to deal with those issues. There are orthopedic injuries from all the increased exertion needed to perform activities of daily survival. There's sprains and strains and broken bones, things like that. Minor infections from lacerations or boils that are left untreated and then can cause problems by entering the bloodstream. They can cause a pretty serious infection called sepsis, and that's something that you might have to be able to identify as well. In addition, you're going to need to know how to deal with more significant problems such as trauma from hostile encounters leading to open wounds and heavy bleeding, things like that. Now, our book has a comprehensive list of all the skills and knowledge that an effective medic should obtain in advance of a long-term survival scenario, and that'll give you a head start on learning what to do in an off-grid setting. You should learn how to take vital signs such as pulses, respiratory rates, blood pressures. You should be able to perform a history and physical, place bandages on injuries, treat various degrees of burns, splint pad and wrap sprains, dislocations or fractures, including traction setups. You should know how to close a wound and when to leave it open. And when I say close a wound, I mean close a wound with butterfly closures, with glue, with staples, with sutures. And maybe more important than knowing how to use all these different ways of closing a wound is maybe knowing when to leave them open, because a lot of these wounds are dirty wounds. Sometimes you got to clean an open wound and you perform routine daily care on it. I think another thing that's very, very important is to be able to identify bacterial infectious diseases like strep throat, or of course wound infections, things like heat, swelling, pain, and spreading redness. These are things that you'll see in wound infections. You want to be able to identify viral infectious diseases as well. Most of the time we're talking about things like influenza, COVID-19, RSV, all sorts of things that can lead to pneumonia and other kinds of serious infections. You want to be able to identify parasitic and protozoal infectious diseases like Giardia. This is something for people that aren't careful enough about disinfecting the water that they have. And that's something that's very, very important. There are a lot of other chronic things that are minor, like head, pubic, and body lice, as well as bed bugs and tick bites, things like that. These can sometimes lead to infections, but most of the time they're irritations, and you have to be able to identify where these things are coming from and how to avoid having your people bitten by them. Of course, you need to identify snake bites and be able to treat that. You want to be able to identify venomous versus non-venomous bites. Now, the venomous snake bites will always have two larger holes in the injury right at the front. That's from the fangs. Non-venomous snakes don't have fangs like that, and they have more of an even-looking bite. You want to identify and treat, of course, other animal bites, dog bites and cat bites and wild animal bites. You have to figure out how to treat various causes of abdominal pain, chest pain, pelvic pain. I'm going through a big list, and really, if you knew all of this stuff, you would actually be a doctor, or actually better than most doctors in reality. You want to be able to recognize and treat allergic reactions and certainly anaphylactic shock. You want to have some of the materials necessary for that, you know, maybe epinephrine, either in the auto-injectors or in vials of epinephrine that you can draw up. You want to identify and treat various skin diseases and rashes. You want to identify and treat sexually transmitted diseases. You actually will find that there are going to be some of those in times of trouble. You want to be able to perform a normal delivery of a baby and placenta and follow up the care in the postpartum period, the 4 to 6 weeks after the baby is born. You want to be able to evaluate and treat dental problems. Dental problems. Wow, what a surprise. You guess who's going to be in charge of that? It's going to be you. It's not going to be anybody else. People are going to be just as likely to see you for dental problems as they are for medical problems. You need to know how to replace lost fillings, treat dental abscesses, maybe even perform extractions. That's probably a good idea because in the old days, 90% of medical emergencies or that were related to dental issues were treated by extraction. And we would go through all of this stuff in our book. Every single one of these things so far that I've mentioned is in our book. You want to be able to perform, as I mentioned before, the proper disinfection of water, preparation of food and nutrition, and enforce it among your people, because if they get sick, you're the one who's going to be having the headaches and maybe the heartaches of having to deal with them when they're ill. You want to be able to, therefore, institute basic hygiene and sanitary practices to the group or community. You want to make sure that waste is disposed safely and that their burial practices are in existence, some kind of protocols in existence for when somebody actually passes away. How to take care of the body without necessarily infecting your water supply. You want to counsel the depressed or anxious patient. You're going to need to have a little bit of empathy and a little bit of knowledge with regards to how to treat people with anxiety and depression. We go through that. We have an entire section of that in the book. You'll see a lot of this, by the way, in times of trouble. Everybody's going to be depressed or anxious in one way or another. You want to be able to put together and manage an effective sick room for wound healing and for epidemic disease. We go through that as well. You want to care for the bedridden patient, and in the latest fourth edition, Nurse Amy puts together an entire section on how to change sheets, how to feed patients, prevent bed sores, bathe people safely. These are some of the things that are important to do. You want to identify the indications for use of different medications, essential oils, and alternative therapies. Well, you need to know the doses of the medicines, and frequency of administration, the side effects of these substances. So now you know what you need to learn in terms of how to actually treat the patient, but you actually need to know what medical supplies are going to be necessary to increase your chances of success. And unlike typical first aid strategies, you need to know how to follow your patient's status from injury to full recovery. With wounds, this means daily follow-up and care. So you got to learn how to take care of a wound from beginning to end. Whether a person actually recovers from that injury or not will depend on how well you take care of it. It'd be great to learn more advanced skills like placing an IV. That's never a bad idea, but it's difficult to accumulate a good supply of fluids. These are prescription items, and the logistics of carrying around significant amounts of fluid and quantity, well, they're heavy load. I mean, it may be beyond the ability of the average person. For example, a liter of normal saline weighs about 2.2 pounds. 1 liter, 1 liter bag of normal saline. That's 1 kilogram. A gallon is about 4 liters or so. And that would weigh 8 1/3 pounds, or 3.78 kilograms. So you'll need more than that if you're going to be the medic for a group. So unless you're sheltering in place, it's just not that easy to carry around. You can find the materials to set up an IV line online, usually without a prescription. I have to say that a thorough internet search sometimes will find a source for these IV fluids. These tend to be temporary as they get shut down by medical boards as they're found out. And that's certainly a frustrating problem for the survival medic. Perhaps the most important skill to learn, basically, is how to enforce preventative strategies against injuries and illness. You're going to spend much of your time observing simple things, such as whether your people are appropriately dressed for the weather, whether they're using hand protection, for example, things like that, eye protection. You should require the use of these things during work sessions. It may be difficult to isolate someone who has an infectious disease, but not doing so may overwhelm an entire community, so you need to recognize situations that place your family at risk. And if you do that, then you avoid many of the problems that might crop up. Listen, I know that learning all this stuff is daunting, okay? Really a lot of stuff to learn. But don't feel that it's impossible or that you can't be a medical asset if you only learn some of the stuff that I'm talking about here. The important thing is to learn enough to treat at least some of the more common medical issues. Once you've learned the basics, you'll be able to take care of 90% of the problems you'll encounter in times of trouble. After that, any additional knowledge will just make you even more effective as a medical resource. This portion of today's show is brought to you by baboons. Baboons, those happy-go-lucky primates that'll steal the ham sandwich out of your fanny pack and give you a friendly little nip to boot. Give one a hug and get a big surprise. Baboons, available at fine zoos everywhere. Hey, one of the common skin and soft tissue issues that you're going to encounter as a family medic off the grid is the occasional boil, otherwise known as an abscess. An abscess is an area where an infection has caused an accumulation of pus. Pus is the debris left over from your body's attempt to eliminate an infection. It consists of white and red blood cells, live and dead bacteria, and inflammatory fluid. The most common bacterial culprits of this infection are Staphylococcus aureus and Streptococcus pyogenes, and these organisms are thought to occur naturally on the skin of a quarter of the world's population. So what causes boils? Issues related to hygiene is certainly a problem in survival settings, or a foreign object lodged under the skin, but could just as easily be hereditary in nature, as some people just have a tendency to have them. I know a number of families in which multiple members suffer from this condition. Other risk factors include diabetes, chronic skin conditions, weakened immune systems like people on dialysis, and intravenous drug use. Those prone to abscesses may benefit by regularly cleansing with things like chlorhexidine, that's HibaCleanse, or other antibacterial soaps. Now, abscesses may form anywhere that there is an infection. They can be found in deep organs, such as an inflamed appendix, in the breasts of new mothers, or in areas of diseased gums and teeth. The most common location, however, is just below the skin, most commonly in the armpits, groin, thighs, buttocks, and face, in terms of severe acne. The average person has many glands and hair follicles that can become blocked and infected, and these are what turn into these boils or abscesses. Now, although microscopic, these are infected glands, and so therefore they can grow as large as baseballs if they're not dealt with. And once they reach a certain size, significant pain due to pressure or inflammation is likely, and this is especially true around the area of the rear, the buttocks. The body's immune system has a tendency to wall off infections. This effort by your immune system to isolate the infection is very praiseworthy, but the walls of the abscess make it difficult for antibiotics to penetrate inside and kill the remaining organisms. In these cases, modern medical care must be accessed to eliminate the problem, but what if you're in the aftermath of some catastrophe and you don't have that option? You might have to intervene yourself, medic, by producing and performing a procedure we'll call incision and drainage, or IND. Before you resort to this sort of intervention, make every effort to use non-invasive techniques, and the most successful of these would be the application of warm, moist compresses to the abscess. This should be performed several times a day for at least 20 minutes each time, and over time, the boil ripens, what we call ripens, and comes to a white or yellow head. With any luck, it'll then drain on its own. This can take a week or so in some circumstances, but the compresses should speed the process considerably. Don't forget to wash the area frequently with an antiseptic cleanser, such as that HibaCleanse I mentioned, chlorhexidine. Some people use witch hazel instead for this purpose. If the abscess fails to blaze a trail to the surface by itself, well, you've reached a point where you must seek professional medical help. Now, if this no longer exists, you can still deal with the issue yourself, and you're going to need soap and water, towels, preferably sterile, antiseptic, ice, a scalpel, number 11 blade or number 15 blade, a needle or a knife blade that's sterile, gauze, gloves, your choice of dressing tape, and let's say triple antibiotic ointment. First, you need to wash your hands with soap and water and put on your gloves. Place ice on the head of the abscess and wait a short time for some numbness to occur. Then, apply your antiseptic, betadine, alcohol, HibaCleanse, over the area to be incised or lanced. You isolate the area with drapes or towels. If your scalpel or other instrument isn't sterile, place it under a fire until it turns red and let it cool off. Have some gauze ready to catch the pus as it drains, because it is filled with bacteria. You do not want to spread the infection, and indeed it has a pretty foul odor in many cases. You dispose of the gauze immediately afterwards. You haven't yet punctured the skin. You need to use the tip of your scalpel, pierce the skin over the head of the abscess where it's softest. This is going to hurt some. And the bigger the opening, the more easily the boil will drain. The pus should drain freely, and your patient probably will experience immediate relief. Although some question its effectiveness, apply some triple antibiotic ointment to the skin surrounding the incision and cover with a clean bandage. Clean the site and change the dressing frequently. Alternatives to antibiotic ointments would be a lavender oil, tea tree oil, or even raw and processed honey. If you have oral antibiotics available, begin a course of clindamycin, 300 milligrams three times a day for 7 days for adults. Clindamycin, by the way, is acceptable in those allergic to penicillin. Very large boils, once incised and drained, are sometimes kept open so as to allow continuous drainage. Oftentimes a wick made out of thin gauze with a dilute iodine solution, otherwise known as iodoform, is inserted to keep normal immune response from closing that abscess wall. And this insertion requires some practice, so reserve this technique only for the worst cases. Hey, we get questions from time to time from many of our listeners or listeners of friends' podcasts. In this case, this is a question from the podcast of our good friend Jack Spirko, who is the granddaddy of all podcasters in terms of survival, the Survival Podcast. Here it is. Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question comes from Nick, who writes, what are the pros and cons of TRT, that's testosterone replacement therapy? It looks like there are some online doctors that'll take your lab results and consult with you about what to take, why, and then prescribe it for you. Is there any long risk of this? Or anything else to be concerned about? Thanks, Nick. Nick, telemedicine is all the rage with some practices purely remote and virtual these days, and that has its advantages and disadvantages, but it's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about testosterone. Testosterone is a hormone produced in the testicles and controlled by the pituitary gland that helps men maintain muscle mass and strength, bone density, sex drive, sperm production, and more. Testosterone also affects fat distribution, red blood cell production, and body and facial hair. What happens to testosterone levels with age? Beginning somewhere in their 30s, men start losing an average of a little under 2% of total testosterone per year. Over time, low blood testosterone levels can lead to, in some, a condition called, in medicalese, hypogonadism. The effects of a low testosterone level can be significant in 1 out of 5 men in their 60s and up to half of all men in their 70s and beyond. Testosterone replacement therapy, or TRT, aims to boost these levels back up. But TRT has had its highs and lows over the last 20 years. Prescriptions rose by 300% following media hype that proclaimed that it restored energy, alertness, mental focus, and sexual function. Now it became a sort of an anti-aging formula. Then, as risk became more apparent, particularly when the FDA ordered warning labels on TRT prescriptions proclaiming a chance of heart attack, stroke, and other blood clots, well, the number of men taking it dropped by about half. So benefits and risks are still unclear for many men. Does it improve sex drive and performance? Yes, it does, if it's due to low testosterone and not other health or psychological problems. Does it increase general levels of energy and alertness, like some claim? Well, maybe not so much. But if you have a very low testosterone level on blood tests, it's thought that TRT is a good option to prevent osteoporosis, or brittling of the bones, certain heart ailments, and other problems. Now, can you elevate your testosterone naturally? Yes, if you're overweight or obese, exercise and weight loss may boost your levels on their own. Now, if you opt for drug therapy, you can find it in the form of injection, pellets, patches, or gels. You rub gels into the skin on a daily basis. They're pretty easy to use, but you have to be careful that no one comes in contact with the treated area for several hours after you applied it. Otherwise, they could actually get testosterone into their system through their skin. There is a nasal gel that's now available that eliminates the risk of exposure to others. Then there are buccal patches, B-U-C-C-A-L. You put these on your upper gum about twice a day, and these patches are convenient but can cause irritation or gum disease. Injections, well, they're given anywhere between 2 and 10 weeks apart. They're inexpensive compared to other treatments, but they may not provide steady benefits. Your testosterone levels may go up and down, and they'll go back down between doses. Subcutaneous pellets are also available. These are inserted under your skin every 3 to 6 months, and they're very convenient once they're in, but they are a form of minor surgery. Besides heart attacks, stroke, and blood clots, you have to be aware of lesser side effects like enlarging prostate glands and urinary symptoms from them, breast tissue formation, acne, lower sperm production, and even worsening sleep apnea of all things. The bottom line, Nick, if you have low testosterone levels, you might benefit from TRT, but it's unclear, maybe doubtful, that testosterone therapy benefits men who have normal levels. Like they always say, more research is needed. Do yours and come to your own conclusions. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, the essential guide for when help is not on the way. And be sure to get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did. And now, a word from our sponsor. Hello, citizen. Are you feeling low? Don't have it like you used to? Has your get-up-and-go got up and went? Well, consider the wholesome goodness of Prevalaxian Balance, a healthy mix of fruits, vegetables, sleep aids, and Alzheimer drugs in one tiny capsule. made from probiotic macronutrients, which are processed down to a fine ash, Prevalaxian Balance will give you the pep you need to run that marathon and get a good night's sleep 10 minutes later. Mix with water and you can use it to seal that hole in your canoe. Prevalaxian Balance, your natural road to good health, a better night's sleep, and a higher IQ. Available wherever cure-alls are sold. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. You've been listening to the Survival Medicine Podcast. For Amy Alden, I'm Joe Alden, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Doom and Bloom Hour with medical preparedness experts Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy. Check out our website at www.doomandbloom.net for hundreds of informative articles about survival medicine, gardening, natural remedies, medical supplies, and lots of other good stuff. Contact us, send your email to drbonespodcast@aol.com or use the contact form on the main page of the website. See you next week.
Are you worried about how dangerous the world has become? In these days of terrorist attacks, natural disasters, or even a future collapse, you need to be medically prepared to keep your family safe. I'm Amy Alton, ARNP of store.doomandbloom.net, where you'll find an entire line of uniquely designed medical kits and supplies for when help is not on the way. For everything from individual first aid kits to the ultimate family bag, go to store.doomandbloom.net today. You'll be glad you did.